city, we will be present among the people, in the streets, following President Erdogan's guidance. Our nation's message are of utmost importance, and we are committed to interpreting and acting on these insights for a better future for our country.
Turkey's opposition Republican People's Party dealt a severe blow to President Erdogan and his party by winning major cities and several provinces in the country. Analysts say this is the result of neglect from the ruling party to the voters' demands in previous elections. Among several issues, the economic crisis and Erdogan's inability to control the lira drop was the main issue for voters. Another one was his double standards on Gaza, which forced many of his supporters to vote for other Islamist parties.
What happened in local elections is punitive voting from the people. We expected the ruling Justice and Development Party to lose in both Istanbul and Ankara. Once again, but this surprising result shows that there is a major setback and that their supporters are trying to send a message. Economy, alliances and parties' performance declined during 22 years are part of it. However, the main issue is that Islamist groups supporting AKP were expecting a different stance from the war on Gaza.
The opposition party did not only win Istanbul, but also seized several districts from AKP that were considered a stronghold of the ruling party. Turkish people believe that a change is needed and that both the ruling party and opposition need to work for the sake of the country and its people.
I think that Recep Tayyip Erdogan deserved it. Why? Because first he did not raise the retirement salaries. Elderly will lose to vote for Erdogan for 23 years. Yesterday they gave their vote to CHP. Prices are raising every day with same salaries. Economy is worsening. He says we learned our lesson for the past 30 years. Didn't you learn the lesson?
More than 61 million were eligible to vote. Voters' turnout was registered at 76% across 81 provinces. The local elections results are alarming for the ruling party. Many are considering it a chance for opposition parties to unite and start preparing for the 2028 presidential run if they want to oust Erdogan and his party. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iranians took to the streets of the capital Tehran and gathered at iconic Palestine Square at midnight after the deadly Israeli attack on Iran's embassy in Syria. They chanted death to the Israeli regime and death to America as they waved Palestine flags. The protesters expressed their support for Palestinian people in Gaza as Israel's genocidal war continues unabated.
When we heard what has happened, we couldn't tolerate it, and we came here for the sake of our martyrs. Our Muslim brothers and sisters, Palestinians, Syrians, are all a part of our own nation, and there's no difference between us.
Two of our generals were martyred, so we have gathered here to show our readiness for retaliation. We are asking the Islamic Republic of Iran to take serious action against these atrocities and the disrespect towards our nation and also the innocent Palestinians.
On Monday, Iran's ambassador to Damascus, Hossein Akbari, confirmed that Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi and his deputy Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi were killed in the Israeli attack.
It is our duty to come out because we felt that even though the resistance movement is showing patience towards the Israeli regime, we are still witnessing that the regime is pressing ahead with its atrocities with the recent incident of the attack on the Iranian consulate.
We have gathered here at this hour to show that the innocent martyrs in Syria were killed amid injustice and impunity by the bloody hands of the Zionist regime. The regime has been killing innocent people, especially children, for many years.
The attack came as almost 6 months into the Gaza hostilities, the regime has failed to achieve its objectives of destroying Hamas, despite killing tens of thousands of Palestinians, mostly women and children. The two slain Iranian generals had been comrades of top Iranian anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani, who was also assassinated in an attack in January 3, 2020. General Soleimani played a key role in fighting and decimating the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in the region, particularly in Iraq and Syria.
A large number of people have gathered here in Palestine Square to strongly condemn the recent Israeli attack on the Iranian consular in the capital of Syria, Damascus, Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
In a statistic which may amaze and anger those in their 20s and 30s, in 1973, the average French person dedicated just 10% of their income to housing. In places like Lisbon, that figure is now 63%, as the housing situation across Europe is being called the worst it has been in 70 years. With winter prohibitions on evictions ending with the arrival of spring, protests are being held across Europe against the lack of affordable housing.
Houses are made for living in, and not for financial speculation. This is a fundamental truth which has been forgotten by successive French governments. They have turned their back on the many victims of our long-running housing crisis, and across Europe it's the same. What's worse is that they'll have many people evicted by landlords looking to cash out on tourist money for the Summer Olympics.
One out of four French people suffer from a serious housing problem, so it's no surprise that better housing has been a top issue for voters in election after election.
There's a real lack of decent, new, and safe housing in France and Europe, as much of our stock dates from after World War II. The laws requiring that 20% of lodgings be made available to lower-income citizens is not enforced, and we just don't see that the government cares about the incredible difficulty of finding affordable housing here in France.
In Paris, housing prices are up a back-breaking 70% since 2009, the start of the great financial crisis, and the failed response of far-right economic austerity. The hiking of interest rates in 2022 caused some housing markets in Europe to decline slightly, but others continued to rise. That also caused building costs to soar, reducing private construction. Housing groups insist that lodging issues could be fixed nationwide in just 5 to 10 years if the government's laws favored renters and regular citizens instead of landowners and real estate speculators. The primary culprit seems to lie in the refusal of right-wing economics to allow governments to invest tax revenue in building more affordable real estate, and also in the vast sell-offs to private corporations of government housing since the 1980s. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This year, the holy month of Ramadan in Pakistan has been dedicated to the oppressed people of Gaza, with Pakistanis asserting that they will never forget the plight of Palestinians in war-torn Gaza. Throughout Ramadan, they have continued to raise their voices against Israel's brutalities and the genocidal war on Gaza. This week, activists from Save Gaza campaign organized protest demonstrations in all major cities of the country. They also staged protest sit-ins to condemn what they perceive as Israel's barbarism in Gaza.
Pakistan should move on international fora, United Nations, OIC and other international fora for ceasefire, to save Gaza, to save Palestinians, to stop this genocide, number one. Number two, establish a humanitarian assistance corridor. Number three, start proceeding against Israel in international court of justice and international criminal court, and also on the platform of the OIC for their war crimes, for their crime against humanity in Gaza.
While leaving the comfort of their houses behind, individuals from different faiths and backgrounds gather on the streets, setting up makeshift iftar meals to break their fast during Ramadan. These gatherings were not just about sharing food, they were about sharing solidarity, empathy, and hope for the people of Gaza.
This is the message from D Chowk, Islamabad, Pakistan, that we are with you. Our hearts are beating in Gaza, and for the regimes across the globe, our message is that you have been exposed. Your so-called democracy, your so-called freedom of speech, your so-called international humanitarian law are badly exposed.
Images of destruction and suffering from the Israeli war sparked a wave of empathy among people from various walks of life in Pakistan, prompting them to increase their advocacy campaign within their communities for the plight of oppressed people in Gaza.
The gesture of Pakistanis holding protest demonstrations and breaking their fasts on the streets to show solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza underscores their steadfast commitment to amplifying voices against Israel's ongoing genocide and advocating for a ceasefire. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is me, Asma. Once more, I have the pleasure to be at your service. And then here with me, I have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Mustafa, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum assalam.
So, as the ritual of this program goes, I would love you both to introduce yourself pretty briefly. Let's start with Sister Nahid.
Assalamu alaikum to you and your dear listeners. My name is Nahid, and I'm so honored to be with you and your listeners today.
Thank you very much for being here, and your brother Mustafa.
My name is Mustafa, and I'm studying here in the Hauza. I'm studying psychology here, and I'm originally from Pakistan, but I've lived in different countries.
So, thank you very much, both of you, for coming here and for joining us in today's episode. So, you must have seen this quote somewhere that says, "We all are the bad guy in someone's story." And it's very interesting to think about it, like, I'm a good person. I feel like I'm a good person, and I always try to be this very fully mannered and cool person toward everyone, but then eventually it's not going to be like the case that everybody is going to be satisfied with me. Like, no matter how good I am, but there is a person who would consider me as that negative role in their stories, in the course of their life. So, have you ever thought about it?
So, I really believe that we cannot please everyone. And even if, like, we have too many Nasreddin stories that he has talked about this fact.
Ah, yeah, by possible. The way, he's a fictional character in our literature.
Yeah.
This guy had a lot of stories in interacting with other people. Yeah, like, whatever he did, really nobody meaningful. Was satisfied with him.
Yeah, exactly. The people were not pleased with him, and all the time he was just trying to make people happy, and the
he
result
was shocked all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, exactly, and the
because
result was
no
the opposite.
No one is going to be satisfied.
Yeah, and I think, like, this is our life. Mm-hmm. It's a real clear sample of our own life. We mm-hmm. cannot make all people happy, and even if we do everything to please all people around us, still there is one person who considers us as a negative character.
So you personally, you think that? Is there anyone who would consider you as the bad guy?
Yeah, sure. I'm a teacher, and I have too many people who consider me as the negative character, but I think it's natural.
If you're a good teacher, then you're the good
person in
everyone's
history. If you want to be this strict teacher, it's so natural that some students may not like you.
You're a strict teacher.
Somehow.
Why are you strict?
And
you have to change yourself.
And it's natural that some people all the time are going to disagree with you or dislike you. But I don't think this should not hurt us. This should not stop us from our own process, like our own way of improvement.
Mm.
And sometimes we should think about it. Sometimes, surely as human beings, we should evaluate ourselves and what
now,
we're doing
in this
world.
Now, from your student, I highly ask you to evaluate yourself and figure out that being strict is not the way to be a good teacher.
But it can help them improve faster.
I have my favorite teacher who I've learned the most from, I would say that he's super strict. He's sometimes strict about certain rules and stuff, but overall, we all love him because first of all, he's a great teacher, right? He teaches really, really well. He makes us laugh in class, for example. And then, he's kind of flexible with us,
but still, there may be one or two students that dislike that teacher as well.
Come on, give up. We're asking you not to be strict.
I don't think you're right. There might be one or two people who don't like his sense of humor.
You know, too many of my students are my colleagues these days. They started with me and now they're working. So we have rapport with each other, but still, I'm not saying that I'm the best and nobody is going to dislike me.
Yeah.
I believe that I may be negative in someone's story.
Yeah, whatever, just as the brother mentioned, the number of teachers that I love are very, they're not that much because the good teachers are very rare. They're just like diamonds. If you get one of them, then you're so lucky. Mm-hmm. But to every single one of them, the criteria they have is modesty.
Yeah, sure.
And is kindness. And they're expert in what they do.
Yeah,
so I guess if you're an expert in what you do, then it's not needed for you to be strict. So this was just a side note to what we were talking about. Why then this case happens?
Probably my wife's story on the back. I know, hopefully I'm not. But, joking aside, we're all trials for each other, right? From a Islamic point of view, we all serve as trials for others. And interestingly, we have two verses of the Quran where one in which, God says your spouse is a source of peace for you, In another place, God says your spouse and your children are a source of trial for you.
He uses the word fitna for you.
Yeah. So you're both. You could be a source of peace, but at the same time, you're a source of trial. And you can definitely take that role of being a negative person. And sometimes negativity isn't always because you're being bad. For example, me coming here to Iran, for example, I know I really ended up hurting my parents, right? Because they really miss me a lot. So in a way, I'm being that negative person, right? But because I'm causing them that kind of pain and hurt, I would say. But it's not always easy to, sometimes you have to make those difficult decisions.
Your parents would, of course, understand your situation.
But when we say
the bad guy, I'm going to ask you this question as well, that who is considered to be the bad guy in your own story? Mm. But think about it, and then when we come after the break, you just tell me. Welcome back to Reality. We're talking about an interesting topic, actually, which is the bad guys in our stories. And then I asked you about if you have ever been the bad guy in anyone's story. But then I'm going to cover up your perspective as well. Has anybody been the bad guy in your story? And how do you just recognize them? I mean, what are the characteristics of those bad guys?
I guess the experiences are the things that shape our labels as bad guys or good guys, even for people. The experiences we have, the feelings that we get from people, and how they react, how they answer to our requests, needs, and wants.
Oh, no.
They shape.
No, it's not based on the answers to our requests.
But they even shape the experience. So that experience leads us to the way of labeling people as good or bad, you know? Imagine you once, I don't know, in a simple way, you wanted something as a child and somebody didn't care about you, and that made you label that person as a person who's not caring and is the bad guy.
I would label them as inconsiderate. I would label them as guys who do not care about others, but I'm not going to label them as the bad guy in my story.
But it's not that easy for kids.
I hope you let go of it by now. That way you're getting older. But I would say that, you know, the people that I would label as bad guys are the people that have maybe lied to me. Yeah, that would be the common sort of denominator.
Yeah, right now as an adult, right?
In adult life, yeah, definitely as an adult. You know, anyone that I felt has lied or maybe, let's say, scammed me or, you know, been untruthful, I would consider those to be the bad guys.
Exactly, you know? Being untruthful. Just being the reverse of what I expected them to be. Like, they are having some masks of goodness when they are with me, but then eventually I come to understand that, no, I just was wrong about them. They were not good people. Like, it's they right. stabbed me in the back. They stabbed my, actually, trust in them.
Yeah, speaking of the topic in this way, I can say that the people who betray our trust are the worst. Mm-hmm. Like, they can be defined as a bad guy in my story.
So,
have
you ever betrayed the trust of anyone? Like, consciously or unconsciously?
I don't know about the unconscious aspect. Maybe I have done it and I haven't recognized it yet. But consciously, no. I have always tried to just keep the trust. Or, you know, I try not to trust unless I can make sure that I can fulfill it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I have done it unconsciously, but consciously, no. I haven't.
Yeah, this is way too much of a personal question. I feel like I'm on trial here.
So then if it's too personal, define goodness and badness.
Yeah, I would say one other. So lying, I said, would be one thing. The other one is maybe like rude behavior. If somebody's like rude to you, I feel those are like bad guys, you know?
We're not going to call them the bad guys in our life. They're rude.
Yeah, but that rudeness makes them the bad guys, you know? Like
the moment you understand or you recognize the fact that they're rude, you're not going to let them be important characters in your story.
Well, that depends, right? For example, I'll give you an example. Like, I was volunteering for an organization, okay? And, you know, I'm not like the employee there. Like, I'm giving my free time, like, to help out there. But the person that was, like, leading that you know, organization, if I was, like, late sometimes, they would become really rude towards me, you know, despite me sort of, like, talking to them about it. When that happened, like, 4 or 5 times, I just stopped volunteering there. I was like, look, I don't need to volunteer. You're going to be this rude about, you know, over the smallest things. But that wasn't only my own experience. This person has done that with, like, 10 or 20 other people that I know, you know. So in that case, I consider that person to be a bad guy. Like, why isn't he learning from his own... I would say he would be a nice person if he learned from his mistakes, maybe. People who don't learn from their mistakes maybe are sort of bad guys, you know? I'm willing to forgive someone if they're willing to change, but if they're not...
Yeah, that will to change. And the feeling of regret is important factors. Like, people who do not go through redemption, who do not go through regret, are scary people. They're so dangerous because they have no borders. And then, just for the record, to mention another point, it's not like always that the bad guys are the bad guys and you can recognize this badness. Like, we see it in different movies. There are bad guys and you empathize with them. What you see clearly is not that they are bad. At the end of your story, you're going to recognize that these people had bad effects on you, like some of the friends that we have.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We have some friends that we love them so much, but unfortunately, the much other people are telling us to be cautious, to be aware of the kind of people you're picking for your community. We do not pay any heed for it because we think that, okay, we are doing the right thing, and these guys, as I can see, apparently are good to me. Yeah. Unfortunately, what's going to happen is that they're going to change us through time without us being aware of it.
Yeah,
so sometimes the bad guys of your story are not going to be recognized as bad guys right at the moment.
2 or 3 years later, or even maybe more, you're going to understand that, okay, the monster that I'm becoming right now is the outcome of picking that person as my alter ego. So this is also another important thing to keep in mind.
That's what makes life challenging and like a dilemma. We never know if the person is an antagonist of our story.
Exactly.
Or is going to be the protagonist.
You come to the end of the story to recognize.
And then we realize that person.
When you have no more of time to go back and change everything.
Yeah.
So, brother, your final words. About how to face these bad guys.
I mean, definitely, I would say, it's part of life, you know. We should realize that's natural part of life. And sometimes, by the way, you know, we all go through ups and downs. You know, our moods, for example, change a lot. Sometimes we do sort of become the bad guy, right? So if my mood is down, if I'm angry with my family, then I'm going to be that bad character. We have to recognize that in everyone. Like, everyone kind of goes through that stages in life. And just take it naturally and, you know, rely on God and pray to God. And just understand that this is just part of life, you know, that you're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, this is part of life.
Acceptance.
And I have to mention this point as well, that there are some good characters, there are some bad characters, but according to me, right now I'm coming to understand that we're a mixture of both. Like, we could be both at different occasions and different times. So it just depends on the amount of badness you're going to share with the environment around you and the community that is encircling you. So this is all. Thank you, brother, and thank you, sister, and thank you to your listeners for staying with us until another session. I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Israeli regime has shown that it is not interested in reaching a ceasefire deal, as announced by Hamas's senior rep in Lebanon, Osama Hamdan. One reason would be since it would prevent the genocidal aggression and the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from continuing. Is this what Israel is after? Does the targeting of aid and aid workers also support that? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the Israeli regime is doing all that it can to extinguish Palestinians on the eve of Quds Day rallies and with the six-month starting date of the U.S. Israeli genocidal war coming up. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Ken Stone, Executive Committee Member at Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, joins us from Hamilton. Also joining us is Zakir Ahmed Mayet, attorney, activist, and political analyst from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Taking a look at what I mentioned in the intro, and that were the statements that came from Osama Hamdan, who's a senior rep in Lebanon, based on the most recent developments concerning the genocidal war. One of the most significant aspects of what he made known in his speech was the fact that Hamas is still at the negotiating table when it comes to this ceasefire. In terms of some of the different parameters that were presented, he said that they were still sticking with what they had presented prior. Things like for the Israeli regime forces to be removed from the Gaza Strip, for there to be obviously some kind of route for the residents of the Gaza Strip to return, especially he noted the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and for aid to be delivered, amongst many others. But overall, he mentioned the fact that it doesn't seem like Israel is interested in any type of agreement at this point, putting the blame on the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and also the fact that any type of ceasefire, as mentioned in the intro, would prevent the genocide from continuing. So let's bring in now Ken Stone from Executive Committee, a member of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who joins us. Ken Stone, welcome. This ceasefire that was mentioned by Osama Hamdan in Beirut, he said squarely the blame falls on Israel, that it's not after reaching a ceasefire, and then blaming the Prime Minister Netanyahu. We know that Netanyahu's political career is hanging on this, but the mere fact that he said Israel is not interested because that would prevent the regime from continuing its genocide speaks volumes. What do you think of his statement there?
First of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting me and wish everybody Ramadan Mubarak. On the question of the ceasefire, Israel does not want a ceasefire for a number of reasons. The first reason is that it wants to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from Gaza, just as it wants to ethnically cleanse them from the West Bank as well, where they've conducted in the last 6 months some 300 murders of Palestinian residents there. They don't want a ceasefire because they want to destroy they want to destroy the resistance to Israel in the West, in Gaza, which is of course Hamas, part of the axis of resistance to Zionism and U.S. imperialism in West Asia. They'd like very much to wipe out Hamas. So, thirdly, they'd like to take over the Gaza Strip because it has an offshore gas field that Israel would like to exploit.
Okay, it looks like your connection, our connection with Ken Stone is not working. Let's go to you, Zakir Ahmad. You know, this thing with the World Central Kitchen Convoy, I think we lost actually both. So I was just going to get into the whole issue of the World Kitchen Convoy that was targeted by Israel. The whole scenario regarding that is basically falls into two parts. One, why was this convoy targeted when the coordinates were given to the Israeli regime? And secondly, given the fact that this was U.S.-based and you had nationals on there, such as from the U.K. and from other countries, it doesn't seem like that even prevented Israel from not targeting it. Which brings about then the conclusion that has been made, some say speculation, but it's a conclusion that have been made by many, as to the fact that Israel does not want any type of aid to be distributed inside the Gaza Strip. This then lends a hand to the starvation that's happening more so in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, where it's showing itself. We have upwards, or the average median, of about 700,000 Palestinians who are grappling with life and death because they're starving. I think around 50 so far have died as a result of starvation. But that number can quickly escalate given the fact that the aid that's reaching into the Gaza Strip is not enough. So that's one of the things that needs to be analyzed and dissected. Another aspect of this war, which has been ongoing now in terms of the complicity, is from the U.S. We are going to be looking at how that is fueling the genocide that's taking place. Even on the day that the convoy incident happened and the U.S. President Joe Biden came out and was in a heartfelt message, showed sympathy for what happened, the U.S. signed off on more military assistance. So at this point, that puts into question the sincerity of the U.S., even though many have said that the U.S. is not sincere, that what it says out in the open or in public or to the media is not what it says to the Israeli regime and how it acts with the Israeli regime in terms of the assistance that it gives that. The whole issue of aid, of course, is very pivotal to the existence of Palestinians. We're looking at the aid workers to have been targeted in large numbers. Kent Stone, unfortunately, you got cut off. I believe maybe it's best for you to continue from where you got cut off, if you remember.
I was saying that the that Israel doesn't want a ceasefire for the simple reasons that they would like to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from Gaza. They would like to destroy the resistance in the form of Hamas. They would like to get their hands on the offshore oil gas fields off Gaza. And they have this colonial project, and they've had it for over a century. They want to create a greater Israel that is clear of the people of Arabs, whom the Israeli government, in the words of Defense Minister Gallant, considers to be subhuman, human animals. So this is the reason that besides Netanyahu's own personal ambitions and survival instincts, that the Israeli government is not in favor at all of a ceasefire.
All right. We're going to hopefully touch on some of those topics, because maybe that gives an explanation as to why you're killing so many civilians from the Israeli regime side. But taking a look at the whole World Central Kitchen convoy incident there, Zakir Ahmed, what is the story there? I mean, the coordinates were given to the Israeli regime, yet it was targeted. We're looking at the fact that even Israeli regime spokesperson, I believe, of the army came out and apologized. Didn't do that for the 32,000, 33,000 Palestinians that have been killed. But more and more now, conclusions are being reached that Israel does not want any type of aid, especially food, to be distributed in the Gaza Strip. And of course, with a record number of aid workers to have been killed so far, is that what Israel wants, because it wants the genocide to continue?
The strike on the aid workers distributing food, we believe that they had certain tons of food with them at the time, and they were transporting them. The entire trip was coordinated with the Israeli regime. They were notified of the route, and they had been tracking the convoy for some period of time. Therefore, the argument that this was an accidental strike can be thrown into the bin. This is intentional, but we have to look at the timing. I believe the timing is particularly significant. The incident that preceded this was the attack on the Islamic Republic of Iran's consulate in Damascus. And this is an egregious violation of international law. It is precisely because of the protections of embassies and consulates that we don't have mass violations. For example, Julian Assange, when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, the foreign powers could not intervene and extract him from there. This underscores the importance of diplomatic sites and access and protections. So when this strike took place in the afternoon, approximately at 5 p.m., Israel needed a distraction. And one of the other distractions that they could conjure up at short notice was to strike this particular aid convoy. We noticed on social media that the attention shifted very quickly from the strikes in Damascus to the atrocities of striking aid workers. This was merely a tactic by Israel to distribute some of the pressure they had obtained or received after they had committed such an egregious act. But going to the other point, Israel has systematically targeted the United Nations Relief Works Agency. It is their campaign to deconstruct every form of aid-giving organization, including this particular one. Their aim is to create a puppet regime. We know that they have made attempts attempts to shape the ground by co-opting tribal leaders, clan leaders, trying to convince them to distribute the aid and to turn their backs on the resistance. This has been openly rejected by the clan leaders, stating very clearly that they would never abandon the resistance and they would never betray them. So this is all part of a grand scheme to deconstruct any aid organization and also to deconstruct UNRWA. But in this particular instance, I believe it was meant to be a distraction to distract from the blatant violations of international law that was committed in Syria in the afternoon.
Well, I was going to get into the Iranian consular building a little later, but let's get into it since our guest mentioned it there, Kent Stone. Of course, if you agree with what our guest there said, whether it was a distraction or it could also, as some have said, is the Israeli regime feeling defeated, whether it's on the ground in the Gaza Strip and the fact that it is fighting on multiple fronts. In particular, the one that's obviously a big threat to it is Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, and it's also on the receiving end of the resistance groups regionally that are targeting Israel, now more so than ever. In the past week, the Islamic Resistance of Iraq, from the Haifa airport to the Haifa refinery, I believe, or that was before. Anyways, it's on the receiving end of it. And the past week is just one example of it. Do you think that it's because of that that it wants to detract the world and then start a regional war, where some say, to bring in the U.S.?
Well, I agree that what the Israelis are trying to do by attacking the consulate in Damascus, which is a blatant violation of international law and actually a casus belli and grounds for a war, grounds for war, an act of war, is because Israel would like to change the narrative. Israel is desperately striking out in all directions because it is not winning the war in Gaza against Hamas. Hamas is still holding its own. It is not winning the war against Hezbollah. Hezbollah is responding tit for tat to all the provocations by Israel. In the Red Sea, Ansarallah has turned the port of Eilat into a ghost town. So Israel is getting more and more desperate and is looking to strike out against Iran and to change the narrative. The narrative of the world now is that Israel is a settler colonial state, a racist enterprise, something that doesn't deserve to exist any more than the apartheid regime in South Africa. This does not mean that all the Israelis have to be wiped out. It means that the government of the apartheid regime in Israel has to go and be replaced, hopefully, with a Palestinian state in all of historic Palestine. The U.S. Is in this deeply because of hegemony. The U.S. had undisputed hegemony over West Asia for about 75 years following World War II. And right now, they only have one reliable ally left there, a really reliable ally, and that is the State of Israel. So they are working hand in glove with the State of Israel to resupply it with all the munitions that they could possibly want, and even send more aircraft, the recently announced long-range attack aircraft, which could be used, right, theoretically, against Iran. So the U.S. is behind this, and the U.S., I'm sure, gave the green light to the attack on Damascus because they, too, want to change the narrative and make Iran the bad guy in West Asia, when actually it's the U.S. and Israel.
Well, you know, if there's anything that needs support of that statement made there by Ken Stone, Zakir Ahmed, is the fact that on the same day that the World Kitchen workers were killed, the U.S. actually agreed to more military aid for Israel. So that kind of shows exactly where the U.S. intentions are. And what the U.S. President Joe Biden says out in the public, as I said before, is not what's going on behind closed doors. The military aid is very pivotal because without it, Israel can't continue what it's doing. We're looking at an average of between 52 Palestinians being killed every 24 hours, let alone the structural damage that's taking place there. What is U.S.'s goal when it comes to this genocidal war. Is it drawing up plans, military plans with Israel as to how it proceeds?
Most definitely. The integration between Israel and the United States reached its pinnacle during the Trump administration. We know that there was an integration of Israel into the central command structures, and there was an integration of air defense radars, etc., during this particular period. So this is an old relationship that has only grown from strength to strength. And the fact that the United States has provided diplomatic cover to Israel when the most grotesque violations have been taking place, despite the ICJ's ruling that there's a plausible case for genocide, despite the fact that they have not complied with the United Nations Security Council resolution, which the United States abstained from. And this was a plan, it was by design. However, even that Israel was not willing to come to the table for. This is an indication that both the United States and Israel are working together towards a regional restructuring. It is very clear that Israel is an extension of U.S. foreign policy within the region and a projection of American power. When we see these weapons packages going forward, and if we look at what was given, it was F-35s that will be converted to F-35Is, the Israeli variant. You will look at the bombs 1,800 and a few others. There's conversions of these dumb bombs to smart weapons with glide kits. These indicate precision strike capabilities. This is not for Gaza. Gaza has been pulverized. They've dropped the equivalent of between 2 to 4 Nagasaki Hiroshima size bombs on Gaza. And it's very clear when you look at the aerial footage and you study the maps of Gaza and the satellite imagery that there's not much left of Gaza, and yet the resistance continues to organically grow from the ground and continues to defeat Israeli armor and personnel on a daily basis. So it therefore begs the question, what was this for? And I think you've hit the nail on the head when you look at the timing. You look at the strike on the consulate, the respected general, I believe his janazah was held this evening, the funeral prayer, and this is an indication that they wanted to strike the individual that was in charge of the northern front and as well as ground forces in Syria. They then proceeded to strike these aid workers, and then you get the aid packages that are coming in. It's to try and shift the Islamic Republic as well as the axis of resistance away from the war theory of attrition and destruction over time to a more offensive war. What it does open up, though, is that Israel is a state that has become a lunatic state. It is committing genocide, number one. Number two, it holds itself up to no rules in terms of international law, violating a diplomatic site and killing such a high-ranking individual. The next best thing that they could do is assassinate a president or a senior minister. That is how ridiculous the actions of Israel are, and yet the United States has failed to rein them in. Therefore, I look at the United States and Israel as one in the same, and the defeat of Israel will be the defeat of the empire. What we need to understand is this is not about Gaza. It's not about even the axis of resistance. It's about the empire versus the global south, those that are oppressed versus those that are arrogantly demonstrating their power and oppressing those around the world. That's the real battle we're facing today.
Yeah, Ken Stone, now, the reshaping of the landscape of the region, I believe, is one of the things that you mentioned that may be one of the reasons, if not a key reason, for Israel to continue its genocide in the Gaza Strip. We know that it wants to carve out a buffer zone and wants participation of certain Arab countries. That's not going to happen based on what's the response has been. But there's another aspect to this, which is this trade route. This has been discussed and presented before, the India, Middle East, Europe, economic corridor. And I don't believe that that's going to happen either, because it has to involve Saudi Arabia. And at this point, Saudi Arabia is not very receptive to what Israel has done. So do you think that Israel is going to continue with these aspirations in mind, in terms of trade, for example, to basically want to push the Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip and then maybe go through with that trade route?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I agreed with every word of your other guest about the U.S. and Israel trying to change the landscape of the what we called or the British called the Middle East, West Asia, and North Africa. And they have been doing that since the war on terror was announced by George Bush. Of course, it was not a war on terror. It was a war of terror against the mainly Muslim people of West Asia, go all the way from Afghanistan across Iraq and Syria and, of course, all the way to Libya. And that plan has not gone away. The U.S. has murdered millions of people in that war of terror. And they have spent trillions of dollars, and they are still occupying Syria, the eastern third of Syria. Their troops are still in Iraq. They have bases circling Iran, and they are in Palestine working their best to help the Israelis create the so-called Greater Israel. So yes, they are still continuing their project in West Asia.
So, Kermit, I'm going to end with you. We're looking at a good state tomorrow. So I'm wondering how that's going to transpire, given the fact that Iran's leader has said that we need to have this support of people around the world, which obviously the Palestinian cause has been getting. What is your projection about what's going to happen tomorrow when it comes to the good state rallies?
I think it's going to be one of the most important Quds days that we will ever experience. The battle is raging on. It's the battle not just for the soul of Palestine, it's the soul of each and every one of us. Those that believe in truth, those that believe in justice, those that believe that there is accountability in this world and that one cannot believe that you are superior to another. And I believe this is going to be a watershed moment in South Africa, Johannesburg. I know that there are Quds Day events and protests taking place outside the U.S. consulate. The United States and Israel is being viewed as one in the same. These are the perpetrators of atrocities, genocide, and violations of all peoples around the world. The Israelis have also become victim to the apartheid mentality and colonialism, as South African, white South Africans were also victims of that, indoctrinated and brought onto the wrong side of history. Al-Quds Day is going to define the world today, tomorrow, and I believe that it is important for each and every one to participate in whichever way they can.
Thank you for that. Zakir Ahmed Mayet, we appreciate it. Attorney, activist, and political analyst from Johannesburg. Ken Stone, sorry, we're just out of time. I can give you about 15 seconds if you want, only.
It'll be a defining moment tomorrow and on Saturday in Toronto as well, because we're marshaling lots of people in view of the fact that the police attacked a peaceful pro-Palestinian protest last Saturday. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. Kent Stone, Executive Committee Member, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Option for today and a better tomorrow.